For me, that's what sets it apart. It's that it makes very clear that gratitude is for other people, not stuff like cars or lattes or money or you name it. That gratitude is actually the emotion that connects people.
Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candice Ridardi. If you love listening to interviews with grateful entrepreneurs who are making this world a better place, be sure to subscribe, share, and leave your groovy review. Today, I'm joined by psychotherapist Pace Lawson. Pace is the author of Gratitude Journey. Having battled cancer and addiction, Pace brings real-life wisdom to his work. With over 10 years of experience, he specializes in helping people with substance abuse and mental health issues, along with couples therapy. As a dedicated family man, Pace's personal struggles fuel his passion for helping others. Expect an insightful chat about gratitude, mental health, and overcoming adversity. Welcome, Pace.
All right. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm doing well.
So tell us your story, and it's probably a good one. How'd you get to where you are today?
Oh, that's a... It's a deep question. First of all, I'm going to have to plug in my laptop. So that tells you a lot. I learned the hard way. I think that's how I got to where I am today. I mean, I suffered tremendously in my teens and into my 20s. Just an extremely dark time in my life. I don't think if I would have, gone to hell and come back that I would be where I'm at today. I would probably be doing something a lot less meaningful. So I'm grateful for the experience, as much as it scarred me. So I don't know if you want details or if that's going to work.
So you can share as much or as little as you want. That's up to you. I do want to share go ahead.
I typically don't talk about myself very much. I spend most of my day listening to other people. And
The whole point of being a guest on a podcast is that you have an opportunity to talk about yourself.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I was addicted to crack cocaine. I mean, in and out of institutions and jails and homeless for a little bit. And really that's not the worst part of it. I think the worst part of it for me was just feeling totally alone. I know that my family cared about me when I was out there in the streets, but I just felt totally alone in the world, and it was just heartbreaking. It was a long road. I mean, for many years, I wanted desperately to stop, and I just kept like chasing my own tail. It was just horrific.
So what brought you, how'd you catch your tail? How did you finally catch your tail?
Okay. So I went to treatment for a second time. I was completely desperate. So I called this place that I'd been to before, Summer Sky. It's somewhere in the DFW area, like south of Dallas. And I'm like, man, I don't know if I can do this anymore. Like I'm going to die if I keep doing this. They brought me back. And at the end of the 30-day treatment period, I'm like, I feel better. Like all the drugs had left my body. I was well hydrated and well fed. I gained probably like 20, 25 pounds in treatment. And the counselor I was working with was like, you're not going home. Like, you're not going to go home. You need to live in a sober living home. You need to move into a halfway house. And I'm like, what's a halfway house? He's like, well, it's a place where you stay and you go out and you work and you pay them rent. And they've got recovery supports and meetings and stuff in the home and other guys living there who are trying to get sober. And I was totally resistant to the idea, but I had nowhere to go when I left treatment. I had no home. And so I really didn't have a choice. Thank God. I mean, I asked my family if they'd let me come stay with them after treatment, and they said no. And I'm grateful that they did. I didn't have anywhere else to go. So I moved into this place in Denton, Texas, the halfway house that's where I found sobriety was there. I stayed there for 9 months and it was an awesome experience. I relapsed twice while I was there. I ended up getting sober eventually. Like, sobriety was a bumpy road. Scott Weisenbaker, the guy that runs the place, he coined this term called the pace effect. I guess not every guy that goes through the halfway house has to be perfect or get it right. That, like, during my stay there, the 9 months that I lived there, I was sober 99% of the time. And so those 9 months of sobriety really changed me. And although I relapsed twice and they had to kick me out, I still found my way. And I think that helped Scott understand that, you know, maybe there was hope even for some of the guys that he had to kick out. So, yeah.
So explain.
That's how I found my tail was that place.
So explain the difference between getting clean and getting sober.
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, as far as terminology goes, maybe that's just semantics.
Maybe explain the difference between what happened to you in the rehab center versus what happened to you in the halfway house.
Oh yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, so clean would be like in the treatment center where the stuff's like out of my system, right? And I'm thinking that I'm, you know, I'm overconfident, right? And I'm like, I got this, you know, a little bit overconfident. And that's a dilemma for most of us in early recovery, is we tend to get a little bit overconfident. Sobriety is more of a surrender. It's more of a, like, I think it's more, it comes from a more humble place. It's like, I don't have this, like, this thing is trying to kill me. And I need to every day stay fit, not physically fit, but emotionally, mentally, spiritually fit. If I don't stay fit, this thing's going to kill me. So I think sobriety is maybe more of a humble position. That's a good question. I've never really thought about it before like that.
I like that answer. Okay, so 9 months goes by. And I mean, the world that you live in today is so much different than the world that you were living in the day you left that halfway house. So what happened after that?
I moved into this little efficiency apartment and I got a paper route. And it makes me kind of emotional because that was just a really special time in my life. Yeah, I mean, I've never really talked about it before in detail. I mean, I hope that doesn't surprise you. I mean, I've been to therapy myself for some family issues that I was going through. And while I was in treatment a little bit, but long-term psychotherapy is, so I understand how my patients feel. They really do feel deeply when they're telling me their stories. Anyway, so it was, I got this paper route and I would wake up, like early morning, go to college, 'cause I enrolled in college to become a counselor. So I was super excited and I was like studying everything that I could about psychology and human behavior. And I would eat, I would rest, and then I would go pick up my papers at like 9, 10 o'clock at night and roll them up. And then like two or three o'clock in the morning, I'd throw them. I'd get back at 6. Oh yeah, I left out the part where I sleep. So then I'd get home like 6 or 7. And then I think I went to school, studied and slept, and then woke up around like 10 or 11 to go pick the papers. But I met my wife around this time. I think that's what makes it like the most special. Yeah, it's definitely her. That's the part of it that really gets me. We're still married. We work together. She's in the other office right next to me. Yeah, so I had to date her, right? And you know, like, she's not going to sleep in the middle of the day and stay up all night. Like, she wants to go out to eat and like early, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when I'm supposed to be sleeping so I can get up and go throw my route. So I would go days without sleeping so I could go out to eat with her, so we could date, go watch a movie. Then I'd go throw my papers and then go to school. You know, one day I overslept because I'd been on a date with her the night before and I got fired from that job. So I went out and I got a new job pretty quick. But yeah, the rest is history after that. I mean, once I met her, everything just started falling together.
That
or falling in place. Yeah.
That fall into place. That makes a lot of sense, because when you find the right match, you know, I thought my husband and I were unique, and then I started talking to other women. But you know, a really good couple fills each other's gaps, right? Everybody has gaps, and when you find the right person, you fill each other's gaps. So when you find the right person, you become whole, right? And
absolutely.
I mean, there are people who can be whole on their own. That everybody doesn't have to have a life partner. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that when you find the right person who fills your gaps, that's when you know that you have a good, strong bond. So obviously she fills your gaps.
Well, yeah. And you know, another thing that I've learned over the years is that we're not necessarily meant to be alone. I mean, it takes an exceptional person to become a hermit, you know, and go live in a cave completely isolated from the world. Or out in a desert, let's say, in complete isolation. I mean, eventually it becomes kind of torturous to be alone.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think we are meant to connect, and it could be, it doesn't have to be a life partner or spouse, but yeah, I mean, those connections with other human beings, and she, for me, really made the difference.
Well, human connect. I didn't mean lack of human connection. I just meant lack of a life partner. You know, because there are people who are perfectly content.
Right.
Never having a life partner, who live full healthy lives, but you know, maybe they don't have as many gaps as the rest of us have.
I'm a firm believer that every human being is wired to deep down want to attach to a life partner. Maybe that's debatable. I've had plenty of people say, like, yeah, I could just go off and live single for the rest of my life, and in that moment they mean it. And then, you know, maybe months or years down the road, they start that longing, you know, kicks in for that attachment. And attachment, I usually define attachment as that person who will always be there for me the way I need them to be.
In your work, have you discovered that it's men that need the attachment more than women? Or do you work with a lot of women?
Yeah, I work with more women than men. Yeah, I mean, women generally are not safe with most men, because many men, unfortunately, don't have the skills to develop a proper attachment. And so they tend to be a little bit aggressive, sometimes demeaning, sometimes possessive and controlling. And so I can understand why women would just be like, man, like, I don't want that, because these are the men that I've encountered. So, So I can understand why women, maybe in your experience, have become a little bit less prone to want to attach.
Well, and you're the psychotherapist, so you probably have more easier access to the information than I would as a layperson. But from what I understand, widows tend to not remarry, where widowers remarry right away. So men remarry after their spouse passes away, and women don't normally. And the safety thing might be it. I mean, they were safe and comfortable in their relationship with the man that they lost, and they don't think that they could ever feel that safe again.
Yeah. And we have to take into account, you know, the LGBT community as well. I guess it doesn't have to be exclusively male and female.
That's true.
With attachment.
Well, and I mean, loss is loss. Losing your life partner is losing your life partner. It doesn't matter what your sexual preference is. You've lost the most important person in your life. Interesting.
Yeah, I haven't crossed that bridge yet.
So talk to me about your book. Why is it different than other books about gratitude?
I don't know. I think the book for me was more of an experiment and kind of a journey for me. I'd never self-published before. And I wanted to publish something like a gratitude journal, but I didn't want it to be just blank lines for people to write on. So I decided to study gratitude and dig into it as much as I could. And what I learned was that gratitude is an other directed emotion, meaning gratitude is exclusively felt exclusively for other people. Like, gratitude is the glue that binds us and connects us as a species. And I think, for me, that's what sets it apart. It's that it makes very clear that gratitude is for other people, not stuff like cars or lattes or money or you name it. That gratitude is actually the emotion that connects people. And I hope I made that clear in the book. I don't know. I think I did. I think that's what maybe sets it apart. I don't know. What do you think?
So I, when I think of gratitude, so here's my gratitude story. I mean, I'm the gratitude geek. I've been known as the gratitude geek for 10 years or so, something, some number like that. I created that for myself. I made up the moniker and then I became grateful. Like I wasn't grateful when I came up with the name, the moniker. I stepped into it over time. My story is that I was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer 10 years ago. Actually, I just celebrated my 10-year cancerversary. And I've been in cancer treatment. Thank you. But I've been in cancer treatment for 10 years, right? So, and I will be in cancer treatment for the rest of my life. It's metastatic. We are keeping it stable. Mm-hmm. I mean, stability is the, where I'm in the word stable, no change. Mm-hmm. That is the word I want to hear when I go to the doctor. I don't ever expect to hear gone, because that's not the reality for me, right? Stable is the word. And when you are living in a situation where at any time stable becomes not stable, right? Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of fear. And so for me, I feel gratitude for every day that I get to wake up. Mm-hmm. So I attach gratitude to the ability mm-hmm. to be here on this planet. But maybe that's not gratitude. Maybe that's appreciation. I don't know.
I'd be interested to learn more about your experience, because it's obviously, how would you describe what it feels like in your body when you feel that?
So I'm in a constant state of feeling grateful. I mean, granted, I do have my days where I'm just like, F you world, but you know, we all have that, but I'm just in a constant state of appreciating that I get to wake up every morning, talk to interesting people on my podcast, you know, meet new and exciting people, have new experiences and share what I know with other people. I get to do all of that. And it feels exciting. It makes me feel good. It feels good, which I think is the whatever we all want to feel. We want to feel good rather than bad. Right.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing that, you know, I write about in the book. It's like feelings are totally subjective. I don't know if you ever did this in kindergarten where you were like with your friends and y'all are like, hey, you see what color is that thing over there on the board, that fish? And they're like, that's blue. And they're like, well, yeah, but how do you know I see it the same way you do? Like, what if my blue is actually red?
It probably
like, what
is.
If I'm colorblind and we just like see, did you ever have that weird debate?
Well, it's possible. Yeah, it is so possible, like, that our definition of blue is different than each other's.
Yeah. And everybody, and nobody really knows. Like, who else knows what you're feeling except you?
Exactly.
Nobody can tell you what you're feeling. Like, you're the only person that knows what it feels like in your body when you're having this feeling, and, you know, and what it does to you and how it affects your behavior and your thoughts. Like, so it's like, that's the beautiful thing about emotions, is you're the only person that can say what it is you're feeling. Nobody else has a right to do that.
Yeah. Well, some people, okay, you're the psychotherapist and you touched on it earlier. What happens when you're in a relationship with a narcissist who tells you that you have how you're supposed to be feeling? How do you deal with that? That's a deep question.
You kick him in the butt.
Really? I mean, that's not the solution. I mean,
I know.
A 5'2" woman cannot beat up a 6-foot-tall man.
No, you're right. I'm just thinking, like, yeah, that's not a good situation to be in. I'm trying to understand what that might look like. Like, how would that look like? Would you tell a story?
I'd have to make one up. Okay. Let's just say that it's a married couple. They've been married for 3 years. They might have a small child, and she wants to go get a job. And he says, no, you have to stay home. And she says, well, maybe I want to finish school. And he says, no, you can't finish school. You're dumb anyway. You know, you just have to stay home and make sure I have food and clean this house and feed that baby.
Yeah. It's coming to me. I got you now. I got you. So yeah, the, when somebody tries to tell you what you're feeling, like we talked about a second ago, that's in the story that you're describing now, that's all about power. That's what that is. So he is retaining all the power. And what we know, and this is all common sense, right, is that you can't be happy in a relationship if we don't share power. So, man, what I normally do is I normally point that out to her, like, you don't have any power. And you're not going to be happy until you have some. And it doesn't seem like he's going to give it to you. So what are you going to do? She's at a fork in the road. And it sometimes it takes a long time for a person to make a decision to leave. It
Well,
takes a long.
it's that safety thing too. Because there's two kinds of safe. There's the safety of knowing that I have a roof over my head and food on my table. And then there's the safety of knowing that I have the power to make my own choices. And a lot of women choose the roof over their head.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially if we don't trust ourselves to make good choices, or
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
it.
our self image won't allow us to believe that we can do it on our own too, you know, like self esteem.
Sometimes I have no idea where these conversations are going to take us. Had no idea this conversation was going to go like this.
Yeah, me either. That's why I figured it would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay, this we have talked about some dark stuff.
Is
Okay,
it
so your
dark?
gratitude
It's
journal.
dark stuff. We
So
talk
you
about
okay,
dark
I know
stuff.
your book is a journal, but it also has guidance on how to connect with yourself and connect with others. Is that what I'm hearing? So it's not just a
Oh,
journal. Let's get
right.
back to your book. Yeah.
Okay.
Sell your book to the audience.
Man, I'm not a great salesman. Man, I would say for me, because I went through the book myself a few times, and some of the other people, some people that helped me with it early on. I think for me personally, though, if I'm speaking for myself, for me, it helped me see how important some of the key players in my life are, especially my wife and my kids, and how much joy and gratitude I derive from those relationships. I think that's what the book did for me. And I write about that a little bit in there. And so, man, for anybody who's feeling low or alone, like I think this book is a good place to start opening our eyes to the potential for genuine human connection through gratitude. And it's just a simple practice, you know, every day there's a simple exercise to kind of awaken that capacity to reach across the chasm and connect with another human to experience gratitude. So that's in there, a little challenge daily. It's 28 days.
That's a good challenge. So for a lot of people, they start with, these gratitude challenges. I can't tell you how many different gratitude challenges I've seen. I mean, there are a lot of them out there. When you have the word gratitude in your moniker, the algorithms, they send you the stuff, right? And a lot of folks, it's so hard for them to even figure out what that one thing is that day. Today, I'm grateful for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But if that's what you have to be grateful for, own it, right? I want to get back to what you said earlier about how gratitude is about connection with another person. But some people can only start with the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So how do you bridge that? How do you shift it from the tangible to the intangible? Because a relationship with a person is really intangible. It's not something you can touch. It's just something that you feel, right? So how do you bridge
Yeah.
that?
Well, it's kind of like I'm grateful that my wife, let's say, made me a cup of coffee this morning. I guess the coffee would be the tangible thing. So I think I do a fair job. I'm not sure if it's a great job, but an okay job, kind of explaining that, you know, or asking the reader, what did someone do that you appreciate? And usually the doing, what the person did that they're grateful for, the doing is the tangible thing, like making me a cup of coffee, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of that's the bridge. I think even one of the days I kind of write about you know, everything that we have, even if it's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, like there's a connection to another human through there. Somewhere down the chain, there was some peanut farmer, you know?
Yeah.
So human hands have touched all these tangible things that make our life more comfortable. And so at the end of the day, there's a human somewhere in the story.
Yeah.
You know, for us to extend our gratitude toward.
That is a really good way to walk it backwards. You know, like all I can think about. So, I mean, I'm so full of gratitude. This is not hard for me. Right. But imagine if all I can be thankful for today is the roof over my head. Right. All I can think of is the roof over my head. Well, there were some guys on that. I'm just using my own house as an example. There were three guys on my roof three years ago who put that roof up there. So I'm grateful for those guys. Right.
Yeah.
And then there were people who made the tiles. There were people who made the nails. There were people who made the wood, and that wood had to be farmed, and those nails had to be that ore had for those nails had to be mined. You know, the materials for those roof tiles had to be, I don't even know what roofing tiles are made out of. You know, they all of that people. Oh, wow. Somebody had to figure out how to make roof tiles. Somebody had to figure out how to make nails. Somebody had to figure out how to plane wood. I mean, it just, you could go backwards and backwards and backwards.
Yeah, you're better at that than I am. Yeah.
Your
story intrigues me, Candace. I mean, so it sounds like you were diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer about 10 years ago.
Yes.
And so there was this pivot point where you changed something about your personality, where you, this gratitude thing started to work on you.
It's not that I changed. It's that I opened my eyes. I started to see things differently. Right. Cause I have a really, I'm a type A personality. I'm always have to be in charge. I'm a Capricorn. I mean, you tick the boxes of Candace has to be in charge, and I fit all of the, all the reasons why Candace would have to be in charge are picked. Right, are checked, right? Everything that has to do with the personality types of this, of the person who has to be in charge all the time, that's me, right? And when you have cancer, you can't be in charge. I mean, I could be in charge of the only thing I could be in charge of was how I felt, and the mantra, and it's a Dalai Lama quote, is I choose to be happy. Happiness is a choice, and I choose to be happy. That is the only thing that I had control over. And the rest of it was, you know, I didn't have control over how the chemotherapy was going to make me feel. I didn't have control over how the radiation was going to make me feel. I didn't have control over the fact that I had an infection. I had to be in the hospital for 4 days. I didn't control any of that. All I could control was that I choose to be happy.
You remind me of Viktor Frankl.
You know, I have never read Viktor Frankl, and I really need to. I really need to read him.
That's some really great wisdom there in you. I'm not that far along. I've still got some character defects that I'm still trying to work out.
Oh,
I mean,
like
that's
I
the
don't?
Thing. It's like, well, I know you do, but it's like,
oh, thanks.
I'm sure you do. You said you're a type A personality. I don't even want to go down that road with you right now. Probably not a good idea.
No, you don't.
No, I'm kidding. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, I mean, it's just that's the thing. It's like, you know, Carl Jung had this quote that I think about often. It said, do you know Carl Jung? I don't know why this guy is just like, I just have like a man crush on Carl Jung or something. But
you can have a man crush on him.
He said, for a tree to reach heaven, its roots must stretch down into hell.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning in your suffering, you have found something quite remarkable, Candace.
My goal is for everybody to feel gratitude for just being here on the planet, regardless of whether or not you've had something shitty happen to you. You know, and obviously you've had a lot more shitty things happen to you than I have.
I don't know. I mean, that's relative. Not Carl Jung, but Viktor Frankl would say the suffering is relative.
That's true.
Meaning he would say it doesn't matter what happened, the suffering is equal.
That's true. And it also has to do with that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. But I am here today because this is going back to the root. I'm here today because Revlon gave money to a researcher whose research funding had been pulled by a pharmaceutical company. That is why I'm here today. And the drug that researcher created has saved millions of lives. But it would not have been created. The funding was cut. It was dried up. It wouldn't have been created if Revlon hadn't stepped in with some cash. And think about how intricate that is and how many lives have been touched, right? Mm-hmm. So every time I think about how crappy it is that I have to go to chemo again, you know, it's only 3 weeks, but actually I had some really good news. If you listener, this is probably the first time I've mentioned it on the show, but I had some really good news recently. I don't have to do one of my treatments anymore. So I only have to go to the cancer center every 3 weeks now instead of two or three times a month.
Oh God, that is amazing.
it's so cool. All right.
Oh yeah definitely.
I mean, it's just that little thing. It means is I'm too old now and I don't need to have the hormone suppressor. But I'm 54, so I passed menopause, right? So but it's still cool, right? It's still cool that little thing. Anyway, back to my story about the Revlon thing. The perspective is I go in for this treatment and I get this drug every 3 weeks that would not exist today if the president of Revlon hadn't been married to a woman who knew the doctor who created the drug. That's human connection.
Oh yeah. That's a remarkable story.
You know, and when I say millions of lives have been saved because of this drug, I am not exaggerating. It's been over 25 years that this drug has been on the market. A
tangible object to the human.
Yeah.
The weaving gratitude through the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are women today that have been alive for 25 years because they've been on this drug. I mean, it is a drug that you have to take for the rest of your life, but it's keeping us alive.
Absolutely.
It's keeping us alive. And it's just amazing. And that's because of one man who said, yes, I will give you some money.
I had a second cousin with metastatic breast cancer.
There are a lot of different types.
Yeah, I don't know what type.
Yeah, there are a lot of different types.
He was on chemo for many, many years, too. You know, I only had to do chemo for like 3 months, man, and that was bad enough.
Well, you're the lucky one, then.
Yeah. And God knows it's going to come back and try to kill me again. I mean, it's scary stuff.
No, it's not.
You never know.
Yeah, that's true. You can't control that, but you can control your attitude and you can control your diet and you can control what you believe and make sure that
your story is very, very inspiring for me.
Thank you. Just pay attention to what your body is telling you and listen to it. Mm. I mean, wow. Okay. So we want to come back to, this is a relationship marketing podcast and we have been talking about relationship development.
What is relationship marketing exactly?
Relationship marketing is exactly what you're doing. You are building your business based on conversations and creating a relationship with your clients. And then I am sure that you get a lot of new clients and new patients through word of mouth that, one of your patients may talk to a girlfriend and the girlfriend needs you and refers to you, or there's another doctor. This is the best way in the health field for referrals for relationship marketing is if you have a connection with the chiropractor and the neurologist and the oncologist and you have personal relationships with them and their clients need you, especially in the world of oncology, because I cannot tell you how many spouses can benefit from a therapist. And they're not getting the help they need because everybody's focused on the patient, but it's the spouse who's driving them to the appointments and holding their hair when they puke and making them broth and trying to get them to eat and all that stuff that the spouses are doing. They're going through it too. And there isn't really a lot of support for them.
Yep. You're totally right.
But that's what relationship marketing is. That's when you create when you create relationships with colleagues, with clients, with vendors, and you're the person that they think of first when somebody needs what you offer.
Got it.
Or you're top of mind when somebody needs what you offer. It's all about.
I just wanted to come on and meet the gratitude geek. That was my goal. just to get to try it out. I just wanted to try out a podcast.
You've never done a podcast before?
No, I've never done a podcast.
You had to have booked this months ago.
I did.
My waiting list is like 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, I know. I did.
And so you have never done a podcast. I'm the only one.
You're the only podcast I've ever been on so far. Yep.
Wow. And you waited a long time. Well, good for you. Good for you. Is it hard?
And I showed up. I show up. I keep my word.
Were you nervous?
Was I nervous? Well, I mean, I'm prone to anxiety to begin with. Mm. So a tad, but it was more excitement.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what I was going to get myself into, and I kind of enjoy novelty and new experiences. So
yeah,
it's more exciting.
Yeah. Well, I hope I was easy on you.
Yeah, you definitely were. I mean, I almost cried a couple of times talking about my wife, meeting her.
Can I've made so many guests cry. I don't do it on purpose. I'm just a curious person and I want answers. Call me the Oprah of podcasting. No, it's not Oprah who made people cry. Who was it? Barbara Walters. And the Barbara Walters of podcasting, I made people cry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Okay. Well, so let's go back to your book. When you released your book, how did you get the word out about it?
Facebook.
Facebook. Really? Mm-hmm. And did you sell on Facebook?
Yeah, just through friends and family and connections and my patients here.
That's relationship marketing.
Yep.
And is it available on Amazon?
Yeah, I self-published on Amazon.
Excellent.
I'm writing another one now, actually.
Okay, what's that process look like?
Well, I'm working on two. I'm working on nonfiction and fiction. So the fiction is called Cain, a love story. So it's a love story about a man and a woman, a young man and a young woman. And he is, should I spoil it or should I stop there? But there's a very dramatic, there's a very dramatic ending. It's a very dramatic ending.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And when is that due out? You're still writing?
By the end of this year.
Awesome. And then what's the other book?
It's on personality. I don't have a title for it yet. But I just love to write. I go into writing about gratitude not knowing hardly anything about gratitude. So writing helps me learn. And I've been trained as a specialist in treating personality disorders. So I have a fair amount of understanding. But I think writing about it will just help me even more get a better understanding. So writing helps me learn.
Yeah.
And writing about personality will help me give it to my clients so they don't have to hear me talk as much. I can be like, here, if you just read this, you'll know my thoughts on personality and you don't have to hear me, you know, repeat myself in session. I'll just do all the listening. You know what I mean? So I can just give it to them.
Here's personality. Do you think that your patients will actually read it?
I mean, maybe not.
I didn't really admit it until recently, but well, I guess I did admit it. So I managed to be a straight A student in high school and college without ever reading a textbook because I am an oral listener and a visual learner. So I don't absorb it through reading. I absorb it through coming up, showing up in class and writing it down, right? Listen, write. If I read it, it goes straight out my brain, right? I don't read books. I listen to books. Right? Because if I read it, I'm thinking about other things and I want to do other things. I'm always doing more than one thing at once, right? So for me, I wouldn't read the book, but I'd listen to it. You know?
What do you call somebody like me who has to write to learn better?
I'm not sure because I'm not a psychologist. I don't know.
I don't know either.
You know, actually, I talked to somebody recently who does that. He trains people. I'm going to have him on the show because he was fascinating. He trains people on how to learn faster. There's global learners who always want, and these are the three that he told me I was. Global learners, they always need to know what the big picture is. Visual learners, they need to get to the point quickly. And verbal learners need things to make sense. So that's what I am. I knew that already. And he said that I have the same personality type as Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, and it hurt my feelings. because I don't want to be an asshole.
Okay.
So I don't want to be an asshole. But
yeah, personality is my thing.
I love but that's the kind, that's the personality, that that's the kind of learner that Elon Musk and Steve Jobs are, global, visual, verbal. But you know what? Because I can identify that I don't want to have those traits that they have, like denying that their daughter exists and, you know, all the things that the other one does, that I don't want to have that personality traits. I can identify that, and I can be grateful that I have these learning techniques, and I don't have to be an asshole, right? I can be a good person and treat people fairly, and you know, yeah. So anyway,
well,
did I tell you that I was a type A personality?
Yeah, maybe I am too.
So yeah, that was really, if you'd like to meet him, I'd be happy to introduce you to him, because I think the two of you would have a fantastic conversation.
Oh, that'd be great. How'd you meet the guy?
Through networking. I belong to a BNI chapter. Do you know what BNI is? No? BNI stands for Business Networking International. It's the largest networking organization in the world. Oh, and cool. This gentleman is Italian, actually. But I do a lot of networking because I'm a people person. I like to call myself a master connector, because when I'm done talking to somebody, I want to at least have figured out one person to introduce them to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's how
I like that.
So introduce. I'm writing a note here.
You can do like an email intro?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That'd be cool.
Yep. His name is Cosimo. And eventually I might have him on the show because he's fascinating. All right. Well, it's time to start thinking about wrapping up. I always ask every guest the same question. There's a couple questions. I used to say marketing, but now I say business because I want to go beyond just marketing. So what is your favorite business tool, tip, or technique?
My favorite business tip, tool, or technique.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite? Oh, man. I would say I can try top three or something.
You can do top three. And it's really important to understand for the audience that psychotherapists are business people. Like Pace has a business. He has a business. Okay. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thriving business too. It's a lot to manage. I mean, first is being vulnerable and authentic. I kind of put those in one, because when my customers or my clients, if it's a business or patients, whatever you want to call the people that we serve, when they see you as a genuine, vulnerable human being, right, not defensive and guarded, you know, trusting, safe, vulnerable. Like that connection, man, it's strong. And they come back and they tell people about you. So just being authentic and vulnerable. And then I'm highly conscientious. And like you, maybe that's the one thing we get, you know, inherited through our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. And maybe Elon Musk and those guys had similar parents, great-grandparents and whatnot. But trait conscientiousness, right? Trait conscientiousness is dutifulness, achievement striving, order. We get things done, and we're organized.
See, I call that having an Asian mother. Place. That's called having an Asian mother.
That helps too, huh?
Yeah.
So being very organized and being very authentic.
Was that three? You said three.
That's There's just two.
What was the third?
Take risks.
That's a
big
good
risks. Yep.
That's a good answer.
So taking I'd say risks. Be authentic, be very well organized and driven, and take big risks.
Yeah. If you can't take big risks, you're never going to get outside of your circle. You know.
Yeah. Have you ever read the book? It reminds me of the book I read 2 days ago by, what's the author's name? Old Man in the Sea.
Hemingway.
Yeah. Hemingway. It's like that. I mean, this guy goes out to sea, you know, catches a marlin that drags him out miles, right? Out to sea. It's the biggest fish he's ever caught that the village has ever seen. And by the time he gets back to shore, all the sharks have eaten it up.
Yeah.
But there was something in it. So taking a big risk doesn't mean we have to like succeed.
Yeah.
We can take a risk and fail and we learn from it. So just take risks.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of that story. Yeah, exactly. The whole point of that story isn't that he brought the fish back, that it's that he got back, that he made it back, that he went through all of that and he made it back.
And that he was the type of personality to even go that far.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh my God. That reminds me of a YouTube video I saw. It might've been on Instagram, but there's this video of this fishing boat. They were like big fish, like a fishing boat. And they see this little dot. So they're filming this little dot and it's a guy in a blow up, like a blow up thing that you sit in when you're, you know, you're sitting in a pool, like a pool thing. I don't know what they're called. Float, a pool float. And he's in the pool float and he has a fishing pole and he had caught something with his fishing line and it had dragged him out. And he's just sitting there in the boat with his little fishing pole. He never thought to let go of the pole.
That's the old man in the sea. That's the modern day version.
And so this fishing boat, they pull him up, they pull him on the boat and then they reeled in the fish. They reeled it in. Audience, if I can find the link to the video, I will share it in the show notes. I probably can't because, you know, those videos disappear once you watch them. But yeah, so that is basically the old man in the sea, a modern version of it. He was so tenacious and he was so chill too. He must have been really stoned or really drunk because he was so chill. Yeah.
Yeah. How do we know the guy even wanted to be rescued? How do we know he was happy about it?
I know.
What if it was all part of the plan? He's like, I'm going to reel in something big and have it pull me out to sea.
But in a pool float. Is that what they're called? Pool floats? I don't know what they're called. But anyway. Anyway,
well, I can see it in my imagination. It's like a big blow up pool with a slide so he can climb up on the slide and slide down.
No, but that's not what it was. It was like a duck or something. You know, it was like an avocado or a duck or, you know, a swan or one of those things. You know what I'm talking about?
Okay.
Those blow up.
I live in high plains. There's water near me, you know, within like 500 miles.
Aren't you, you're in the Dallas Fort Worth area?
I'm in Amarillo, Texas, which is.
Oh.
Way up there,
that's a desert.
Closer to Colorado.
Yeah, it's a desert. You're in the desert. When I first moved, I lived in Houston for 20 something years. And when I first moved there, I didn't really know. I had visited, I mean, my employer had flown me out to meet, you know, to interview me and everything, but I'd never really been to Texas. And we drove through, a friend of mine drove with me so that I didn't have to make the drive myself, but we drove through. We hit El Paso, and we're driving through I-10, and it's nothing but desert. There's nothing but desert. And then we hit San Antonio or something, and it was like this freak winter where it was cold, and there's icicles hanging off of everything. I mean, this is Houston. You know that was a freak weather, right?
Absolutely.
And it's just really cold, and it was a really nice winter. It was a really mild winter. There wasn't a lot of humidity. And then April comes around, and all of a sudden, I step outside and I can't even breathe because the air is so thick with moisture. And I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what humidity was.
I call that muggy, man. Yeah. It's just muggy.
Anyway, it was like, I didn't even know the right word to describe what it felt like. Anyway, Amarillo's not that.
You start sweating. Mm-hmm.
Texas is so big that it has different climates. Like I lived after my husband and I got married. We bought a house on the lake, on Lake Conroe, which is about 60 miles north of Houston. And it's in the forest. It's in the, you know, the Piney Woods area. And you're in the, you know, so you're on the complete opposite side of the state. But yeah, I mean, how many people know that there's actually a national forest in Texas and it's huge? It's like this ginormous forest. It goes on for miles and miles and miles and miles. It takes up a good portion of the state, you know? People don't know that. And then you're driving towards Louisiana. And you hit marsh. I mean, the state, it's like a whole country in one state.
Yeah. I live up in the desert and it takes me 19 hours to get down to South Texas.
Yeah.
19 hours.
I mean, hours.
It's probably closer for me to get to Canada than it is for me to get to South Texas.
That would make sense.
Maybe not quite, but close.
We drove from Houston to Michigan when we moved. It was 20 hours. I don't remember, but yeah. Yeah, I just went back. I was really missing the food. I mean, I really miss Mexican food a lot. I was only in Houston for one day, and then I went to Dallas for an event. And so I waited till I got to Dallas to have Mexican food. People, if you want really good Mexican food, you have to stay in Houston because Dallas doesn't understand Mexican food. Mm-hmm. Just saying. Okay.
Stay in South Texas. Yeah, that's where it's
Yeah.
at.
Yeah, because the food I got in Dallas was not Mexican. Anyway, all right, we need to wrap up. So, Pace Lawson, this is your moment of gratitude. For whom or what are you most grateful?
Well, obviously my wife, as that happened. I didn't expect to get all emotional about my wife popping up in the story in that efficiency apartment, but yeah, definitely her.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. Our theme music is track 14 by Rev Brock and Soul Lily. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for all the groovy ways to connect with our guest, Pace Lawson. I've been your host, Candace Rudardi. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.